It's clear and 83 degrees. At Willard Airport in Champaign, clear skies, 82 degrees. Winds out of the south at 14 miles per hour. Occasional gusts up to 20. The humidity is 39%. The barometric pressure, 29.99 inches and falling. And outside our studios on Friends Plaza, it's 84 degrees. It's 12:40. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Two dozen people in four continents have been charged with trafficking in stolen credit cards and bank account numbers. 11 of the defendants were arrested in the United States. They were caught after allegedly using a website set up by the FBI as part of a sting operation. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
FBI officials said the arrests yesterday amounted to the largest coordinated international law enforcement action in history. It involved 13 countries in North America, Asia, Europe, and Australia. The operation centered on what's called a carding forum that was set up 2 years ago by the FBI. It went by the name Carter Profit. Such forums are used by cyber criminals to trade stolen credit card and bank account information. The defendants went by names such as Cubby and OxyDocs. One is said to have used the site to sell credit card information he got by hacking into a hotel website. Another allegedly used fake serial numbers and stolen credit card information to obtain replacement parts for Apple products. And a third is said to have sold malware that could steal people's financial information by attaching itself to their computers and recording their every keystroke. The malware sold for $50 a copy. FBI officials said some of the defendants were accomplished hackers. One is said to have stolen information from a bank and online retailers and sold it to other people. He was caught after allegedly selling the information to an undercover FBI agent in exchange for a laptop. Another defendant, who went by the name Josh the God, is said to have obtained 50,000 stolen credit card numbers. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Now to the London Olympics. Among those counting down to the Summer Games, two rowing hopefuls. American women have been dominant in the eights in international competition. That's boats with eight rowers. The U.S. team has won the last six World and Olympic championships. In fact, the American team's so strong and so deep, many talented athletes prefer to look for spots in other rowing events. Qualifying for women's pairs was recently held in Princeton, New Jersey. NPR's Mike Pesca was there.
The finals in the women's pair have just ended. Eight people are snapping pictures of two exuberant athletes. The cameramen are not members of the row paparazzi or any kind of rowing press. And by the way, for these qualifying events, the word press needn't be plural. The photographers here are Sarah Zelenka's and Sarah Hendershot's parents. The rowers have also drawn a sibling each and what seems like three friends. That's it. Stand next to the sign that says Olympics, says Mr. Hendershot. Come on, Dad, says the newly minted Olympian, Sarah. The crowd is not overflowing, except with pride. Carl Hendershot.
She has such drive, such power. I believed in her from the very beginning. I kept saying it all along. If I had 1,000 Sarahs, we'd take over the world. She's just incredible. I hope she didn't hear that.
Hendershot and Zelenka came from behind in the race and in the rankings to nip Amanda Polk and Jamie Redmond for a spot on the Olympic team. The heartbreak for Polk and Redmond is doubly piercing because they were among the eight rowers that won the world championship. But rowing is an unsentimental sport. Redmond and Polk were beaten for spots in the big boat and here today upset by the two Sarahs in their attempt to make the Olympics in pairs. Many of the members of the Olympic 8 team who train in Princeton were on hand to hug their new Olympic teammates and to see them attain what Sarah Hendershot describes as the stuff of girlhood fantasy.
I think when I was in the fourth grade, I did this book report on Janet Evans, and she was my complete idol. I saw her as this smaller girl who worked her butt off and was amazing. And I swam as I was younger, and I thought I was going to do it in swimming, and then got a shoulder injury. And when I found rowing, I realized that this is what I could do it in.
If you notice the reference to a smaller athlete, realize that Hendershot and her partner are both 6 feet tall. Rangy according to the actuarial tables, but not necessarily for their sport. Even so, Sarah Zelenka's height is what drew the eye of a recruiter for the rowing team on the campus of Michigan's Grand Valley State.
This guy on Grand Valley campus was like, "You're really tall, you should try rowing." And I was like, "Okay, let's do it." I didn't like it at first. I was like, I'm too afraid to go away from the dock. But after a while, it just became great.
In case you were wondering if Grand Valley State was a secret rowing powerhouse, it's not. Hendershot went to Princeton. Here's the list of colleges that the members of the Women's Eight graduated from. Stanford, Ithaca, Yale, Berkeley, Harvard, Princeton, and Penn. So Sarah Zelenka's road, or river, isn't the usual one, though she and her partner's next stop, London, is quite prestigious. There, rowing experts will not list Hendershot and Zelenka as among the pairs expected to medal. But history suggests the two Sarahs have never been dissuaded by other people's expectations. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
I have an original Leroy Neiman print at home. It features goaltender Glenn Hall making a save against the Montreal Canadiens during the inaugural season of the St. Louis Blues back in 1967. Neiman died last week at the age of 91. He captured many great moments in sports history. His painting style and his personality were, well, one of a kind. Commentator Frank DeFord remembers the man and his art.
Framed in my library is a sketch that Leroy Neiman dashed off of me on the back of a menu when he was watching me speak several years ago. Leroy, who died the other day, was somewhat better known for another sketch, the so-called Nymphette, that's appeared in Playboy since 1955. But, of course, he's ever famous for simply being our most celebrated sports artist. This is hardly to say he was acclaimed. Rather, he was dismissed as a garish show-off who was all about colors and celebrity, more of a Peter Max without any of the grace or subtlety of Norman Rockwell, who he was often popularly compared to. Unschooled sports fans paid well for Neiman canvases, though, and Leroy appeared unbothered by the unrelenting criticism. Part of the professional disdain was no doubt manifested by envy. His television ubiquity and his illustrious physical recognition highlighted by that great sweeping 19th-century mustache. One bitter cold night in Manhattan, Leroy found himself in the wrong part of town with no cabs in sight. He was, as was his winter wont, wearing his full-length mink coat when he realized he was about to be set upon by three thugs. When he turned to face them, though, one cried out, "Hey, you're the guy who paints all the sports stars." And rather than mug him, they found him a cab. Personally, though, Leroy was not at all flamboyant, but courteous, gentle, and wonderfully philanthropic. Maybe it wasn't great art that he sold, but it ended up funding great art schools. His studio just off Central Park was a huge aircraft hangar of a room, but it was a warm, welcoming place. It's odd that sport, so gritty and vivid, so naturally celebrating the best of the human form, has not produced an accepted master since George Bellows fashioned his boxing paintings a century ago. Ironically, just now, as Neiman passes on, a Bellows exhibit is showcased at the National Gallery in Washington. At the National Art Museum of Sport in Indianapolis, there are many fairly recent glorious works, but none are so well regarded as Stag at Sharkey's, which Bellows painted back in 1909, lurid and dark and mean. But Neiman sold. Maybe we simply don't want to display sports art that shows the squalid side. After all, the iconic athletic piece remains the discus thrower, which was carved 2,500 years ago. It is clean and graceful and elegant, a male Venus de Milo. So criticize Leroy Neiman for making bright beauty of sport, but it seems what we prefer. And as the simple sketch he did of me fades, I'll prize it still, not for its craft or its value, but for the kind, generous man who chose to see sport above a handlebar as a razzle-dazzle of glory.
The comments of Frank DeFord, who you can hear early every Wednesday on Morning Edition. His latest book is a memoir entitled Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. Just one note, we have some important maintenance to do on our transmission tower this afternoon. We are replacing a beacon on our east tower, and in order to get the work done safely, we'll have to operate at reduced power starting at 1 o'clock today. We should be back up to our full power later in the afternoon. And a reminder, you can always hear WILL AM 580 nice and clear online at will.illinois.edu or through any HD radio at 90.9 FM HD3. Thanks for your patience as we address this important work this afternoon. We'll try to work as quickly and safely as possible.
WILL is listener supported. You hear us say it all the time. When you contribute during this pledge drive, you help to keep the news and information flowing. You can check out our progress when you visit our homepage at will.illinois.edu. From the homepage, it's a simple click on the word support in the blue bar, and you can add your gift to our fundraising success. Again, that's will.illinois.edu. And thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 27th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Lucille Clifton, born in Depew, New York, 1936. It's the birthday of Alice McDermott, born Brooklyn, New York, 1953, author of six novels, including The Bigamist's Daughter and Charming Billy. It's the 97th birthday of writer and radical activist Grace Lee Boggs, born Providence, 1915. Her parents were immigrants from Guangdong Province in China. Her father ran a Chinese restaurant in downtown Providence. Family moved to New York City, and the girl won a scholarship to Barnard, studied philosophy there. She went on to get her Ph.D. at Bryn Mawr, and because she was Chinese, she could not find a job, not even at department stores. So she headed to Chicago. She got a job at the University of Chicago Philosophy Library. $10 a week. She lived in a basement filled with rats, wore the same clothes every day. The rats were so bad, she went to the Southside Tenants Organization, started working with the black community in Chicago, became a community organizer, and a few years later she met a black auto worker from Detroit, Jimmy Boggs, recently divorced, six kids. He was 2 hours late for their first date. She put on a Louis Armstrong record. Boggs said he hated Louis Armstrong, but by the end of the evening he asked her to marry him, and she accepted, and they were married for 40 years. Grace Lee Boggs wrote a number of books, including Revolution and Evolution in the 20th Century, and most recently, The Next American Revolution, published when she was 95. And it's the birthday of Helen Keller, born in Tuscumbia, Alabama, 1880. The story of her childhood is well known. She got sick, an illness that left her blind and deaf. Her teacher, Ann Sullivan, managed to communicate the letters for water while running water from the pump on the little girl's hand. And she started to learn. She was very bright. She went off to Radcliffe College. She became a celebrity. She met Mark Twain. She became a popular lecturer. She